Welcome everyone to season 7, episode number 76 of Underserved. With me in studio today is Paul Belt, lead developer at Core Strengths. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Thank you, Paul, so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thank you for having me.
So what got you interested in technology? You were part of like the Commodore Army back in the day, right?
Many years ago. So to put things in context, we didn't have internet. We pretty much had boredom was the default state of being. Our video game arcades, when you pop quarter after quarter in for a few minutes of entertainment, was kind of the de facto standard of video gaming. You look at my progression of toys from Lincoln Logs to Legos to Transformers to computers, and it's just increasingly more and more complex puzzles.
I thought Lincoln Logs were underrated. I had those way back in the day, too.
The old-fashioned wooden ones, yeah. They were fantastic. A lot of kids are like, what's a Lincoln Log?
So are you programming at all back then?
Not until I was 7. We got the Commodore, like I had mentioned. It was a Christmas gift, fourth grade or so, mid-80s. Like I said, I saw the games. I found a couple that I couldn't beat. So I figured out if I understand how it works, then I can understand how to get around the constraints that are providing you the challenge. Turn the volume all the way up on your television so you can hear the clicking on the safe. I would not have figured out how to beat that game had I not figured out how it was written, and that was assembly. It brings you very, very, very close to the hardware.
Yeah, some would argue too close.
Yes, yes. It's too much like thinking, which is why I love high-level languages.
You were in Franklin, Mass, right?
Yes.
Did you run a BBS there as well?
Yes. Apogee was a nemesis. We ran Aphelion. Kind of competition, but not really. They focused more on apps. We focused more on games. You know, he was 40-something. We were teens, tweens. Very big into the wares scene. We didn't call it wares back then.
They hadn't labeled it yet.
Right. It was just, you know, software. And hey, the companies are putting in software protection. And now that I'm on the other side of the fence making money, I'm just like, they were overcharging for what they were giving us.
So you end up going to school at Northeastern for college?
Ultimately, yes. Didn't learn much, to be frank, but that's just passion. If you're going to be doing it anyway. The problem was that I couldn't get the job because I couldn't convince anyone that I knew what I knew. You know, I had tried. I'd been able to work at a local bulletin board system. I was able to pull in some contracts here or there, maybe build some computers before Dell was the thing. Freelance consultant, basically, to my local Gigabytes parts store to source all my materials and then go build people computers. It was really hard to market myself. And the industry really wanted and demanded that you have a piece of paper. So
that undergraduate degree.
Yeah. If just to get your foot in the door for an interview, it's different these days. Hell, Google's trying to even undercut everyone and saying, we've got no degree required. Pay us. We'll give you certifications and badges. Okay. Better than nothing. And not every university is the same. A lot of them are just degree factories. They teach you the syntax, but they don't teach you how to engineer.
And I feel like they're in a bubble. Like the cost of higher education now is just insane.
Yeah, it doesn't match the service provided, which is kind of a theme of my career.
All right, so after Northeastern, where do you end up working?
First place was financial.com. A bit of advice to anyone joining the industry. Don't just take any job just because it's in the industry. I learned a lot working for that first company. Mostly it was because the CTO was absolutely brilliant. And I didn't know what I was worth. I had no mental model of what it meant to be a professional programmer. So I just went out and said, yeah, give me market rate. And then like a year later, it's like, yeah, here's a 15% raise. Here's a 5% raise. Here's a 10% raise. Like they just raise after raise after raise because the CTO could see the talent. I didn't see it, but he saw it. He believed in me. And I was just cranking out feature after feature after feature, you know, code factory. At the end of the day, I didn't love it. It's not about the writing the software that I didn't love. It was something I just couldn't put my finger on.
And is there a theme or any lessons you saw over and over again during your career?
Oh, absolutely. To quote Shakespeare, to thine own self be true. The best you can do is make sure that you are your authentic self. Just be yourself. I had a chance to work for this small company that was a dating website for people who wanted to cheat on their spouse. You might have heard of it. Ashley Madison? Yeah. But I couldn't see myself, like, at the end of the day, if, you know, where do you work? I don't want to be associated with that. That's not who I am. I don't want that as my epitaph.
It's hard to get behind that mission.
To each their own. You know, some people don't have a problem with that. But I wanted to be me. I wanted to be happy with what I was doing. And after years, like a decade of working and just chasing money, working .com after .com after .com, at the end of the day, I was just looking myself in the mirror, brushing my teeth and just thinking, who have I become? Is this money worth it? So I stopped chasing the money. I found the first job that I was qualified to do at this point in my career, still Ruby on Rails, and found Channing. And it was because of who I knew. And more importantly, they knew of me because of reputation, because of Northeastern. Turns out that my boss, Marsha, best boss ever, her husband was dean at one of the schools at Northeastern. And had heard of me through one of his peers who was affiliated to the College of Computer and Information Science, where I was a volunteer student to help out the IT department and just explore new concepts and things like that. Because, you know, if you're trying to protect a university network from computer science students, you need as much help as you can get.
Now, the theme there that I see that has actually come up several times with other underserved guests is you went, you volunteered to do something, and there was no, like, payday in sight for doing it, but, you know, you were interested in it and got involved, and then it led to something like this that you wouldn't expect, you know?
Oh, yes. For that reason, I am blessed. I haven't worked a day in my life in terms of what I've been asked to produce with using the computers. My definition of work is having to interact with humans. I wouldn't be where I am today. I wouldn't even be in this chair if it wasn't for being respectful to other people, being able to relate to other people. We may not have anything in common, but you still have to be nice or kind. You know, you still have to respect others and find out more about them, take an interest in them as humans.
I think, and respecting differences.
Yes.
Like, I think that's a lost art these days.
Absolutely.
Everyone hears something that they don't like, gets triggered, and, like, you know what? Different folks are going to be different.
You know, society has been into algorithmic bubble. You know, we see the news that we like because that's what our eyeballs are looking at. That's what we click on. That's what all the metrics are geared toward. It's about collecting eyeballs and making you feel like you want to belong to something that's bigger than yourself. You know, that's fundamental human nature, but we're using it to a detrimental effect. Like, you can leverage it to make money, but you should also be able to leverage it in ways that aren't detrimental. If all you ever hear is apples are red, well, what about Granny Smith? What about the yellow apples? There's 1,400 plus species of apples. And some people are just afraid to try that other apple or just, you know, have a conversation with someone who has a different point of view. I have a neighbor who is just, to this day, a Trump supporter. He, his wife, myself, Vivian, we go for a walk around the block every night and we talk anything respectfully. We hear their political viewpoints, they hear ours, but it's a conversation. It's not a competition.
So you said Marsha, you're working for Marsha Goetsch at Channing Laboratory?
Yes.
What'd you get to do there and what did you like so much about working for her?
She was absolutely brilliant. The second person in my career that ever made me feel stupid. Marsha grew up in the days of punch cards. She was the director of computing facilities for Channing for 30-something years before retiring. She basically made me her pet project. She'd give me an idea and just say, this is the idea for the app, go make it a thing. Any resource you need, here you go. She entrusted me with the quote-unquote bureaucratic power, you know, I'll say root bits on production servers, for example. Well, I didn't have direct access to that. I had access to the people who had it, and I didn't need to go through anyone to get whatever I needed. And no one ever told me no, so I basically just cobbled together whatever systems were needed and built whatever I needed to manifest her vision.
Now, what sort of systems were needed there?
Conceptually, I'll say a debit card, so you can spend grant money to get access to compute nodes in Amazon.
That's interesting. How does that, what are the nuts and bolts of building that?
Oh, geez. So I have to start with Partners Healthcare, which has the LDAP system, a lightweight directory access protocol, which is basically username, password, first name, last name, that kind of thing. It effectively acted like a session management system. Second piece is the piece that actually spins up and shuts down and pauses the Amazon cluster compute nodes, etc. And the third piece is the piece that is the debit card. So upload your budget through an Excel spreadsheet, import that into the database, and then render it in a simple front end, yes or no. And once approved, that becomes the budget for that quarter. So once it's been approved, you know, red, yellow, green stages, because big bureaucracy thing. So try to simplify all the spending of grants and assigning of grants and do the, is this grant ready to be consumed? You know, red, yellow, green. Then as someone wants to simulate this chemical on that organism, spin up, say, 5 nodes and spend $500. And once you spend $500, it will automatically pause. Or don't put a limit on it and just go spend the grant. And when you get close to the end of the grant, send an alert, an email alert saying, hey, you're about to run out of money. We need more money on the debit card.
Can you like aggregate grants together into your spending, or is it?
That has to be, because you can have multiple grants funding a single research project. In fact, that's kind of how some of the more complex ones happen. I'm more concerned about, is it accurate? Who has permission to it, et cetera. And most importantly, what value does it bring the organization? And to me personally, true thine own self be true, what is the organization doing for society? Channing, being a cancer research laboratory, it's making my hours of my life, which is a limited time. I don't know how much I have, but it's scaling to solve problems that will last generations. It's a legacy. I don't want my legacy to be convincing people to spend money they don't have on products they don't need. We're already financially burdened enough. You know, our wages haven't increased since 1970, effectively, but the cost of living has gone up for everything, so we're getting poorer. I can't impact people that way and then live with myself in a happy way. Like, I don't feel good about that. So I'm voting with my time, my attention, my dollars, and I'm only giving all of that to people and organizations that are trying to make the world a better place for everyone, not just their own niche.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Are there other themes or ideas that you've tried to kind of interweave into the work you choose to do?
I do know of a theme other than the altruism, socially responsible theme. A theme that keeps coming up in my career is wage stagnation, because you've seen my history. It's every few years I jump ship. Most of it, in fact, wasn't even my choice. It was market forces, you know, layoffs or greedy bosses or just politics within the organization. You know, I wouldn't have chosen to leave Channing, for example, but I was getting significantly underpaid. I might only get, you know, a 3% raise, but if inflation's 7% that year, compound that over, you know, 10, 20, 30 years as a career, you're not doing yourself any favors. If I want my wages to be competitive with inflation, I have no choice but to jump ship. Every time you get hired, you're going to be hired at market rate. It's a way of keeping pace with market. Companies want loyalty, they have to pay attention to the market forces and adjust internally accordingly. And just to brag a little bit, my current company does exactly this.
What are some things besides being able to get better compensation or snapping yourself to the market? What other things do you believe in when you're choosing a place to work or to not work somewhere anymore?
Two things I look for. One is, what do they need me to do today? Because everyone's trying to solve that short-term, 3-month, 6-month window problem, you know, maybe a year or two problem out, because that's how businesses tend to operate. But, well, that's great for the company. What about my career? This is a two-way street. What am I going to learn? Who am I going to be exposed to? What is the organization's mission? There's no point in staying in an organization that doesn't value you or want to see you grow.
What about from a coworker's perspective? To paraphrase you, the hardest things in programming are coworkers and interacting with other humans.
Yes, Todd, the other developer, he sucks. And 6 months from now, I'm Todd with code that I wrote. Worst developer ever is Todd. Just pick on Todd. I was in one position for 4 years. The first 2 years, incredibly toxic, not great for my mental health. I go home, I complain about work. I'm just bringing that negativity home. It made my relationships with my significant other and our son really difficult. It made my relationships with my parents difficult because I was obsessing, like, how could they do this? How could they behave this way? How could they be so myopic? Eventually, I just gave up and said, you know what? I'm getting paid anyway, whether I bust my butt or whether I deliver just enough to not get fired. And then I reached out and started asking people I knew and said, hey, listen, you know me, you know who I am, you know what I'm capable of. I need better than that. And this is like a Fortune 500 company. It was a toxic place. It wasn't healthy. I wasn't happy, even though it was an altruistic mission. The difficulty in working with someone who refuses to acknowledge which side of the Dunning-Kruger curve they're on doesn't necessarily mean that you're an engineer, that you understand those principles.
But didn't you figure out a way to quantify exactly what that drag was?
Yes, yes. This industry is rife with people who believe that they're engineers, but are really just software developers, or worse, just syntax jockeys. They understand the syntax, but they don't understand the constructs, like when to use a for loop versus a while loop. If you're a software developer, you at least understand the difference. The best way that I found to combat that was to make it a human resources problem through data. And political correctness has infected certain products that, oh, screw it. I'll pick on Atlassian with Jira because they measure velocity and they do a great job at that for what they are. But if you take Jira, which you can quantify with StoryPoint, what has been delivered on an individual developer by developer basis, and you overlay that with other data from like GitHub that says this person's made this many commits, and you look at other data also in GitHub called churn, how often does this code have to change, like, or probably how much has it changed, like who made the commit, who then had to go over that same code and redo that code, you can quantify these things.
Or if someone else had to come in and start fixing bugs for them, even worse.
Right, that's drag. That's where the political correctness has corrupted the product.
Because they won't measure drag?
Exactly. No one wants to measure negativity. No one wants to tell their boss anything negative. So everything being spun in a positive light can be brought to such an extreme that, yeah, we have this full-time developer, syntax jock, but it's taking up two full-time engineers to fix what that one developer had wrote. And if we just didn't have that third person, if it was just those two senior engineers, then you're going to get much better results because we're not spending half of our time figuring out the mental gymnastics that this other person wrote. It's algol, it's logic, there's only 63 directives. It's a language. It follows syntactical rules. Listen to Yoda and you know what I'm talking about. It can kind of understand it, but you have to think. And I'm being paid to think. And while I like to do it, you don't want to have to think unnecessarily. Keep it simple. Keep it concise. You know, if it's a 100-line function, it's doing too much. You know, and these are just basic best practices. And this person, this one specific person, let's call her Amy, refused to acknowledge value in something as simple as static code analysis or consistent format. You know, the tools that are helping enforce best practices that exist across all languages. You know, consistent parentheses and spacing and things like that. There's tools that help us with this, and she just didn't see the value.
So you measure drag. Like, what is the actual metric? Like, what did you find?
By an order of magnitude, Amy, her productivity, she was an order of magnitude less than the worst developer in the organization. And the drag was approximately just over 1 to 1.25 full-time employees outside of her to clean up what she was doing. And this just kept going on and on month after month. And it wasn't just, hey, we're complaining about this one person. We're complaining that nothing's being done about this one person.
When the other highly functional and productive developers keep having to like anchor themselves and fix just someone who refuses to learn or improve themselves, it's just so demotivating. Like, then you get into the problem of them quitting.
And that's exactly what happened. Our lead developer said, screw this, I'm going back to France, which meant that it was pretty much just me on the API side and this other person. And eventually the boss just said, I can't work with this person anymore. She's just really a horrible developer. Here's the numbers to prove it. HR, please help. And that's where I learned HR is not there to protect the employees. They're there to protect the executive. And this woman was an executive's sister-in-law. So she got the advantage, because of who she knew and the relationship she had, of human resources protection. She bounced around from one squad to another, and it got to the point where no one was willing to work with her because of how toxic she was. I'm still traumatized talking about it. You can probably hear that.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first.
You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office, and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
Speaking of trauma, once upon a time, you were doing some Perl development as well, right?
Yes. Write-only language. That was definitely traumatic.
I used a bunch of it like back at Monster, prior to Monster, a couple gigs after Monster, and it's super effective at certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some cool features like the spaceship operator and stuff like that that you get into, and you're like, oh, wow, and the CPAN has a library for darn near everything.
CPAN was amazing. The biggest problem was lack of curation.
Yeah.
And honestly, the quality of some of the stuff in CPAN wasn't and still isn't quite up to par.
You had to go do some trial runs with it and figure out whether or not it was a usable library or should I just write my own?
Well, better than PHP, where you have to reinvent the wheel.
Now, you spent some time doing Ruby on Rails, but you mentioned one gig where it was more like Ruby in Rails, but
yes,
not really making use of it. What was that like?
It certainly helped me learn SQL better. The name of that gig was essentially how many requests per second can we squeeze out of the least amount of hardware? It was an advertising.com. It was fun from a technology perspective, but I think that was the nail in the coffin for me working in the ad industry because I was still not getting compensated for what I was worth, still not being respected as an individual. It was soul draining. But essentially, what the CTO had done there was say, I know SQL, Ruby on Rails is hot, we need more engineers because I don't want to have to be the sole engineer on this project, so let's hire a desperate engineer. So he wrote all these SQL statements, put them into sometimes functions, sometimes class functions, sometimes constants, and every request that came in effectively just generated an SQL statement and then executed it. And that was it. And that was one part engineering for me and one part operations. And the fun part was simply being able to do the hand wave and say, I need another database stood up and someone else would just go do it. So I didn't have to because been there, done that.
And you had another gig where someone came in and said, hey, I know Sinatra. Therefore, I wrote the book on it. We're going to use it.
Yes. That was another.com. They hired a consultant and paid him reasonably well for what they asked him to do, which is effectively an admin interface in-house to their existing database. And this guy had literally written a book on Sinatra. So he used what he knew would work and then hands it over. And the VP didn't like that because he was expecting Ruby on Rails. So they let go of that consultant and bring desperate consultant in. Again, not being recognized for what I know because they're just seeing capitalism and everyone's a syntax jockey or a developer. No test for real engineering. If you know the domain-specific language, you can get the job. But I inherit this project and I saw what the company was doing and I was so fed up with the industry. I was being paid like $25 or $30 an hour, but billed out at like $125 an hour. Effectively, I took the Sinatra project and the guy had shown me how to hoist it into a controller, but hadn't quite finalized it and got it working yet. It was the thinking that he showed me. Like, it's just a Rails app. You know, the Sinatra and Rails are both rack. So if they're both going through the same fundamental HTTP dewrapping layer, you can use Rails routing and route it into Sinatra, let Sinatra do its thing, and Sinatra can then respond and just, okay, let it go through Rails. Yeah, it's a longer code stack, but it gets the job done. So wrap the Sinatra app in a REST controller. The VP didn't know any better, didn't care. He just wanted Ruby on Rails so he could attract talent.
So it was Sinatra in disguise or Rails in name only?
Rails in name only, and then start ripping apart that one route so it will match multiple routes because that's what the Java developers knew.
Now you had another gig where someone wanted to get some AWS experience, so hey, let's implement AWS. What happened there?
So in the interview with Kua, is now my current boss, I had mentioned we had similar experiences growing up before puberty with a computer that's line-numbered BASIC with very limited capability. Learn it inside out, upside down, and backwards in 3 to 6 months if you're really passionate. So he recognized that. And when he said, you know, what do you want to do? Well, I can bill you for Ruby on Rails because that's what I'm good at. And it's what I've been doing for 10 years. But I really kind of want to get back into ops a little bit. It's changed since the days of bare metal. You know, we have this virtualization thing. We have this thing called the cloud. I'd like to get some more experience with that and get that part of my skill set that's atrophied more modern. When I had started, I figured I'd go into operations, networking. I did a stint at Akamai because, you know, networks are expensive. I can write code on a calculator. My first line of code was on a calculator. But that also means you get the 3 a.m. phone call. Well, if you're doing it right in the cloud, you don't get 3 a.m. phone calls. So operations as an industry has caught up to what I would want out of such a position. The lack of 3 a.m. phone calls with access to the really expensive networks that allow me to facilitate customer experience when they have problems using the system. Thankless job for the most part, but it's what I happen to like, debugging production problems, because I have that background where I know when to and when not to make changes. And my boss has given me access to production and directly this time. For the first time in my career, I'm not freaking out of, oh my God, I have rootbits on production. Really does come down to the people you work with, the relationship you have with them. Who has my back? Do they have the right attitude? If you're always afraid of getting fired, you're never going to want to explore. You're just going to play it safe, and that's going to stifle creativity. It's going to stifle passion.
So you mentioned coworkers again, and yes. I think one key to knowing how do I get along with people is, you know, what type of personality are they? I've taken a personality assessment that my kids gave me that's like you get bucketed in one of like 16 different things, and I know there's Myers-Briggs.
Yeah, Myers-Briggs is 16. The big five, Ocean, is another big one.
How is Core Strengths kind of in that industry, and what are they doing better than the others?
Myers-Briggs is not reliable. If you take it multiple times, you will get different numbers. It also phrases things as a specific dichotomy. And from my experience, very few things in life are actual dichotomies. So you're already starting with what I'll assert to be a false measurement system that is unreliable. If it's unreliable, scientifically speaking, it is not valid. As an information scientist, that means I don't have time for Myers-Briggs. I don't care. There's too many other things in my life that can be quantified and reliably so. The SDI is reliable. People have taken it for more than 50 years or so and have never varied more than 5 points out of like 65,000 possible points. So it's fairly reliable. Basic theory is you have certain motivations, which are kind of like an anchor, and you have a set of strengths, which are your buoy, and you can choose which strengths to deploy and when to yield better communication within relationships. If you also understand that other people also have their set of anchor, their buoy. Some people very much prefer to focus on the performance of code. Some people very much focus on the maintenance of a code. Some people focus very much on the terseness of code. You know, if you have all of these competing motives, but you're all still marching to the same tune because you're all still working for the same organization. You have to respect this reality. And if you understand what the other person's motivations are, and you understand what strengths they tend to use most often, then it makes it easier to tailor your message to a way that they can and are willing to receive. I tend to overdo analytical, as an example. So when I come home from work and Vivian's just sitting there complaining about a coworker, she's doing this, I can't stand her, blah, 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 I'm hearing problem, 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 problem. And I'm thinking solution, 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 solution. Because I analyze. That's just what I do naturally, instinctively, having coded since before puberty.
She wants to hear that she's heard. She
yes.
wants to feel supported. She wants some empathy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if I understand that that's her motivation behind what she's saying, the message she's sending, she's saying, without using the words, I don't feel supported at work. She comes home. She wants to be supported at home.
That woman is such a jerk. I understand, honey.
Exactly. And it's made understanding this, the relationship and that everyone has their own motives has absolutely changed my career trajectory. This new metric of personality assessment, shall we say, the not Myers-Briggs, the SDI. I love this theory. It helps me understand humans and classify us in a way that Myers-Briggs could not. People, performance, process. You want to kind of get people to see each other's viewpoints and look at things from not their perspective and get that harmony through everyone being comfortable in saying what they feel needs to be said.
Why do you feel it's important to be humble?
Have you ever worked with the arrogant jerk?
I've worked with him. I've been him. You know, it depends on the role.
Yes, likewise. I hate having to be that arrogant jerk. I don't like playing that role. But I've had to before. We all have. However, the arrogant jerk tends to make it more difficult to get the job done moving forward. It might give you results in the short term, but in the long term, if you're going to be working with these people in the future, it's kind of like a marriage, even if it's only a 2-year or 4-year marriage because of inflation and greed and unbridled capitalism, then you still have to see these people. You're still, quote unquote, married to them. You still need to get a job done or you're not going to get paid. So what's ultimately important to you? If you're just motivated by money, then go after the money. If you're motivated by the process, then work on the process to make sure that the behaviors are capped.
Mark Carberry, previous guest on Underserved, said, you don't work for any one given company. You work for 128, meaning that highway that rings around
Boston. Well, not anymore. It's 95.
Yeah.
But yes.
You can still find a 128 every once in a while posted on there.
Up by Salem, especially. Yep.
Yeah. The idea that you're going to see the same people over and over in your career and
it's a small friends, world.
Friends may come and go, but enemies accumulate.
So. Yes. Oh, I love that expression.
So yes. You should, you know, kind of make sure that you get along with people, treat them well, and you never know, you know, 5-10 years down the road, that person may be key to helping you get somewhere. Maybe it's knowing that person at that company you want to get into. And if you've turned them into a zombie, it's not going to be good.
One of the people in the before mentioned toxic place with the person I will continually call Amy. They went on to Amazon, and Amazon has been trying to pilfer me for quite some time now, many years. And I finally got sick of it this year after like the 8th attempt, like 8 different people in AWS reach out to me and say, hey, you have a great background. And I don't want to say this person works for you, no way in hell. Just because I know that person, I've worked with them, I know how they are to work with, and I will not work with them again if I have the choice. I've had relations with them before, and I don't care. I'm not going to put in any effort to restore them, and I'm pretty sure they don't have any interest in restoring them because they have their careers set, and I have my career set. So we can agree to disagree and go our separate ways.
Yeah, sometimes you learn a lesson by working with a person or a group of people, and that lesson may be, I don't think I want to work with that person anymore ever again.
There's limits. Like, I try to keep things positive, progressive, and productive, but there are limits. And this one trauma experience in the workforce was one of those limits where it was just pushed too far, no matter what I tried to do to say, I don't want to be Ruby on Rails developer anymore. The more I pushed that, the more they dug in their heels and said, you're just a Ruby developer. They're clearly not interested in my career growth. Why should I show them any kind of effort or loyalty? So I moved on, they moved on, and everyone's happier for it. And I would recommend to anyone trying to break into any organization to do the same. Have some respect for yourself. As desperate as it may get, you can vote with your dollar. Best advice is, again, be yourself, be authentic, be a part of something bigger than yourself, or it's going to be a very, very lonely career. You can't do it alone. The systems are way too complex. You can't know everything. Figure out your needs and your wants, and figure out what you're willing to live with. For one, I'm not willing to work for any organization that's not willing to put in effort to me as much as I'm putting in for them, and I advise everyone do the same. If we hold corporations accountable for their actions, and we hold individuals accountable for their actions, if you treat me well, I will treat you well. That's human nature. And I don't understand why more organizations don't realize that. There are lots of lip service that says, yeah, look at all of our perks. But look at the policies that back up those perks. My current organization, and I'm trying not to brag about them, but we have a standing policy. You do not ask. You tell us. My kid's going to their first day of second grade. I'm taking the morning off. And you get it off with pay. Because those are the moments in life that matter. You are there for your kid or your children. They're not going to remember you sitting in front of a computer ignoring them making money so they can go to Disneyland. They're going to remember the time you spent with them at Disneyland. If the organization doesn't have policies backing that up, if their behavior and words don't back up that you're a person before an employee, don't work for them. I don't care who they are, how much they're paying. The money isn't worth it. When I stop chasing money, I'm actually getting paid now almost 3 times as much as I was making at Channing because I stopped making money and started making a difference. To thine own self be true.
It makes a lot of sense. And I think some people really have to kind of stop and look at what they're doing in order to realize, hey, maybe I need to make a change. I don't know of anyone who on their deathbed says, I wish I'd worked a little more.
Exactly. There are limits, and you have to figure out what your limits are for you, what's right for you, and how you want to contribute to this world, and then seek out employment in those organizations that are making the differences that you want to see. Whatever it is that makes you happy, if it's not harming others, just do it. You won't be working anymore. Then you wake up and you can't wait until your coworkers get online. This is the things that happiness is made of. How many people do you know can't wait to get to work? Like, they see the weekend and just go, oh, what am I going to do this weekend? I have nothing planned and I have no energy to do it because they're just so burnt out from a job they hate. They spent all their mental energy just doing that thing 9 to 5, day in, day out, going through the motion. But if you love what you do, ooh, I can't wait to go into work and draw that person. I can't wait to go make that commercial. Whatever it is that makes you happy, do it. Just don't harm others. The world is hard enough.
Amen. Paul, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you, listeners, for your time, and very special thanks to Andrew for inviting me.
Live long and prosper.
Live long and prosper.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.